Hi, everybody. It's Amy here. I'm doing the intro instead of Nikki. Surprise. And I'm here again with the lovely Nikki, my co-host. And we have a surprise guest this week, which we're so pumped about. Dr. Julia King. Thanks so much for being here. And I'm going to do a little intro on Julia. So Julia, I'm so happy that she's here. Dr. Julia King is a psychologist and yoga teacher with an integrated mind-body approach to psychology, or psychotherapy, my bad. She specializes and truly loves working with people struggling with anxiety. She particularly has a love of working with people struggling with worry, overwhelm, social anxiety, health anxiety, and panic attacks. She also experienced IBS and difficulties with gut health, leading her to accidentally develop a specialty in treating anxiety and IBS. So, super pumped that you're here. I know we've met through a mutual friend that connected us. And I know in the previous conversations we've had, it's like there's been a lot of connections on the work you're doing. And I think with Nikki and I just working in the IBS and gut health space, we kind of have our frustration with some of the lack of awareness around mental health and gut health issues. So we're like super excited to have you on just to get some knowledge that's a little bit outside of our scope and dig into your brain a little bit about the mental health and IBS space.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to be here and I'm excited for this conversation. I think it's interesting that you had said, and we have talked about how I have accidentally developed a specialty in this area. This was not something I knew about. When I transitioned into clinical work, which I had been a forensic psychologist for 10 years and then transitioned into clinical work, which is a whole nother story. But so I was seeing people generally trying to figure out who I really like to work with. And turns out anxious people are my folks. So love working with them. I get them. I'm in that, that's the space I operate well in. And all the stuff that I teach my clients, I use myself. So I know that they work. But over and over and over again, all of my anxious clients were marking on their intake paperwork, IBS, IBS, IBS. And so on. And then we noticed that their bowel symptoms or their gut health symptoms improved as their anxiety got better. And I thought, what is this about? So then I started digging and realized that, oh yeah, this is a thing. This is a very real thing. And so then there's the issues with the gut-brain connection and how anxiety manifests in that way. And then we have this whole secondary issue about being anxious about your gut health, right? So it's not even just, yeah. So like the issue within the issue. So it's been, fun and really interesting for me to delve into that and really powerful to see those changes, and have clients get better and make these connections for themselves. So,
yeah, no, that's wild. I can't wait to dig deeper. Cause like Dr. Nick, or I always say Dr. Nikki when we have like guests on but usually I just call her Nikki. So it's funny. But Nikki and I always talk about too, like just what you were saying, like the pursuit of gut health becoming an anxiety in and of itself. So I'm so glad that you brought that up. And I think, what I hear in the IBS space and what we've talked about in past conversations is that sometimes, like, when the clients that we're talking to go and they work with a GI doc and the GI doc says, oh, well, it seems like you're just really stressed. And it's sort of presented in this dismissive way, like, oh, we don't really know what's wrong with you. You're stressed, like almost like it's like guilt tripping people, like, ah, you need to like get your stuff figured out. Like, right. And I think that that's something we see a lot. And I feel like because that has been a part of the history of a lot of people that have chronic GI issues is going to a GI doc and not getting much help. And if the mental aspect or like stress, anxiety is brought up, it's sort of brought up in a dismissive way is what we've seen. I think, what would you say to someone who's in the IBS space and is a little bit resistant to the idea that like maybe stress or anxiety is driving their symptoms.
Mm-hmm. So I've certainly gotten referrals from GI docs, but not as often as you might think. Actually, most of my referrals for GI symptoms come from GI-specific RDs, right? So dietitians who specialize in gut health are sending them my way. But I do have relationships with a couple of good GI docs, but for the most part, I'm not getting those referrals from GI docs, which is surprising to me because when I do talk to them, they, I think, are frustrated in working with their patients because they don't know how to fix them. And the GI docs that I've developed a relationship with are like, thank goodness I know you because I don't know what to do to help them. Go talk to Julia, right? So, sorry, what was your question? What would I tell them about? Oh, right. So when they, a lot of times when that initial phone call will say, they'll say, why do I need to see a shrink, right? Like, why do I need to go see a psychologist or a mental health professional? And so we then start talking about how their anxiety can manifest in their physical body, right? Like, there's so many physical symptoms. And I know we had talked about like maybe touching on the limbic system and the role that that plays and how that allows those symptoms to show up in the body. But it really is helping people understand that mind-body connection and that your mental health, good or bad, right, can show up physically in the body. Well, I don't want to say good or bad, right? Like that's the black and white thinking that gets us in trouble. But when you're starting to have stress in the body and that shows up in a physical way, that there are definitely things that we can do to target your thinking and your behavior that can improve the way that those things are happening in your mind. And then that translates to those physical symptoms in the body. So I find a lot of clients, once we understand that, once I'm able to explain that, then they get a little bit more on board that you're not coming to me because you're crazy. You are not coming to me because these symptoms are just in your head. We know that cognitive behavioral therapy can actually improve your gut symptoms in a direct way because of the way that this shows up in your brain. Your brain translates this emotional experience physically into your body, and we're able to, which is wild to me, we can use your thinking and behavior to affect what's going on in your brain and therefore affect what's happening in your gut. It's crazy amazing. So, yeah.
Well, if you think about it, like the stereotypical view of like panic attacks and anxiety, as far as a physical manifestation, would be like rapid heart rate and increase in blood pressure and maybe like sweating.
Yep.
So it's like we all kind of acknowledge that that can happen and that's a physical manifestation of something in the mind. But then making the leap into like bloating or diarrhea or constipation, I think that sometimes people don't always connect GI to that. So I like the way you worded that, that you have physical manifestations in your body from things like stress and anxiety, and just seeing those connections can help.
I tell clients a story about a lion and a zebra, which I can tell you quickly if you're curious, actually. Like a way to kind of demonstrate the limbic system. But so I talk about how you're like, if you're a fat, happy little zebra eating grass on the savanna, right? Not a care in the world. You're perfectly happy. And then you perceive a lion over there, right, in the grass, who's got his little ears down and he's checking you out, you know, over the top of the grass. And what happens to you as the zebra if you see the lion? The switch gets flipped in your brain and automatically these things start physically happening in your body because that fight or flight response is automatic. We don't have control over it. And if you're a zebra and you're seeing a lion, we really do hope that that's automatic. We don't want to have to think about that. We need to like GFO. Right? Quickly get out of there. So when that switch gets flipped, what automatically happens is the heart rate picks up, the breathing gets shallow because we need lots of oxygen. We oftentimes have tingling in our hands because all that blood is concentrating to the center of the body to keep everything moving. So that's why that's very common. Those are common symptoms of panic, which we'll talk about in a second. But the prefrontal cortex is taking up lots of energy. We don't need that energy. We don't have to make decisions. We don't have to concentrate. We don't have to abstractly reason about anything. So turn that off, put that on mute, right? Which is why lots of clients who are having anxiety can't concentrate, feel like they can't think straight. And the other thing that happens, all that grass that you were just eating, like, get rid of it. It's dead weight, right? So release valve, right? Go, get rid of it. So all of that happens in an instant. And Zebra's got, like, some serious evasive maneuvers. He gets away. He finds himself in a nice, lovely little clearing with no lions. He's checking it out. He's like, great, right? I'm good. and that switch automatically turns off. So what happens for us when we are the zebra in a modern society is that we're perceiving lots of things that aren't lions and labeling them as lions, which could be all kinds of stuff, right? Like ordering coffee from a barista if you have social anxiety, responding to an email. Emails become lions. People with health anxiety, like a standard physical or mammogram, or all kinds of things become lions. And so we label those things as lions. Our body is then responding in this way because it thinks that there's a threat, a very threat to our survival. And then we never get to a clearing where it gets turned off, where we feel safe, where we're like checking to see. We're like, all right, good, the threat is gone. So the body is just, you know, and when I tell that story to clients, they're like, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? I get why this is just something that's actually happening in my lizard brain, evolutionarily designed to protect me and keep me alive. And once they're starting to be able to pick that apart, they become a lot less anxious and a lot less afraid. And then they understand, too, that these GI symptoms that they're having are not their fault. They're not broken. They're not, you know, that's, I repeat that to clients over and over and over, that a lot of this stuff is very, very real. And it's a learned pattern of behavior that we're able to unlearn, to pick apart and unlearn. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, I love that. And I'm going to think about that now, even in my own life, like the lion and zebra scenario. And even like, if you think about it from a programming point of view, almost like if the nervous system is like a big computer and we have different programs that we're running, it doesn't make a lot of sense to allocate the time and energy and neurons to have one particular program for if you see a male lion, one other program if you see a female lion, right, one program if you see a tiger, which would be very confusing if you lived on the savannah anyway.
Right.
Like, you won't have programs for like each individual threat. Instead, it's easier for our brain to just have that binary, like, yes, no, on, off. Oh, I've got a GTFO, as you said, or I can stay and eat my grass. And I love that you brought up something as simple as, like, emails or ordering coffee at the whatever. Like, I literally, one of the things on my to-do list for the day after podcast is answering emails because I've been dreading it and putting it off for no real reason. Mm. So I'm going to tell myself when we hang up, this is not a lion.
Yeah.
It's just emails.
So you're
bringing
there's
nothing dangerous lurking.
Nikki, you're bringing up another, like, so we can talk about this whenever you guys are ready, but avoidance being a huge piece of maintaining anxiety, right? And so much of this is so subtle, and this is why people have a really hard time addressing anxiety on their own, because so many of the things that we intuitively do to make ourselves feel better, like avoiding responding to emails, oh, I'll just do it tomorrow. We feel better in the moment, but then it just, you know, it just lasts longer. So the longer we avoid it, the worse it gets, and we just maintain and exacerbate or make our anxiety worse by avoiding it. So, and like when, if we're thinking about, go ahead, sorry.
No, I don't want to stop you. You were on a roll.
Oh no, go ahead. I can just roll and roll and roll.
Okay. And now we were so polite, I don't know if I remember exactly what I was going to say. It'll come back to me if it was really good. Continue.
Okay. Well, and now did I just lose my train of thought?
While everyone's regaining their trains of thought, I did want to mention too, and we've talked about this in the past, but I find too, the more that you bring in the science behind things, and I know you were mentioning this too, about educating your patients on this stuff, because the science behind it tends to, like, the pieces fall together and people really feel like they understand it and that they're not broken and that it isn't something that they should feel guilty about. Like I was saying earlier, in some of the GI docs, it's kind of like, oh, stress, but no real solution. So like, oh, it's just your stress, more in a dismissive way. And I think when you break down the science, it makes so much more sense. And I think the pieces kind of fall together for people. So I love that, again, you're able to break down the science and educate people. And I'm sure that you find that the education is so huge, because if it's not clear, it's just harder to address.
Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite things to do, actually. And I think it's one of the things that I happen to be pretty good at is being able to provide that education and get it to people in a way. Because I have clients say repeatedly, oh, I never thought about it like that before, right? So being able to break it down into small pieces and have them then, one of the phrases I use a lot is being able to determine the landscape of your own anxiety. So we want to identify the thoughts that are contributing. So because our thoughts are hugely powerful to impact how we feel. Yeah. And so if you're, you know, when you're getting ready to public speak and you know, your stomach does that little flip, that's totally created from your thinking, right? And the labeling of something as a threat or a lion, maybe a baby lion, if you're not terribly afraid of public speaking, maybe a giant, you know, male lion. Actually, the females are the ones that are really going to take your head off, right?
Yeah, the female lions are the ones that kick ass and kill you.
Yeah, like, right. Totally.
I worry about them more so.
Absolutely. But so
girl power.
How you perceive things and how you label things creates this experience of anxiety and those physical symptoms and those GI symptoms. And then we engage in a behavior in response to how you feel. And if that behavior is avoidance related, it makes it worse. So then it creates this vicious cycle, right? So when people are able to be like, oh, I'm thinking this, and that's why I'm feeling this way. And then I'm making it worse because I behaved in this way. It's super empowering because now you know this is what you're thinking, this is how you're behaving. And when you're able to target those things, you can change them and feel better, like massively better, right?
Yeah. No, I love this discussion too because Nikki and I work with so many people deep in the IBS space that have been avoiding tons of foods, usually following lots of different diets, have done them all, have done every diet variation you can possibly think of. And what I find, and I know Nikki finds too, is that like nutrition takes a hit, like the mental side of things, you know, the relationship with food becomes not healthy in a lot of the scenarios that we're working with our clients. So talk a little bit about that same scenario, but with kind of the diet as an example, because I think that can be something that we see with our clients is that the food anxiety becomes an animal in and of itself that we have to really pay attention to when we're working with our clients' patients, because, you know, if we don't overcome if we can't overcome food fears, it's really hard to move forward. So talk a little bit about that. That'd be really great.
So I think, I mean, if we're just thinking about avoidance, it's classic avoidance,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So we start labeling certain foods as dangerous because for whatever reason, right? And you guys maybe can, I see it like that those foods are going to create symptoms.
Right.
Or they're going out to dinner and they can't eat this, or this because they, you know, don't want to have an episode or have to run to the bathroom or whatever, right? There's all kinds of things that get labeled. So the way that those foods are labeled as dangerous or off limits or whatever, right? So the thinking around those foods becomes inaccurate, right? And so then we experience anxiety as a result of that thinking. And so then we avoid it and we steer clear of it. And then it just gets scarier and scarier and scarier the longer you stay clear of it. So this comes up for me a lot with clients that are referred by dietitians, because this is impeding the dietitian's ability to work effectively with their clients because the clients are afraid of adding in new foods. And I have to say, like, it's I have a lot of clients that are not easily convinced that this is a great idea.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we know scientifically that the diversity of foods in your diet is good. And we want to increase the diversity of foods to increase the lots of good gut bacteria, right? But I think that this is a real challenge for people because they're afraid. They're very afraid to add those foods in about what the reaction or the results are going to be. The other thing that I think too happens is where we're trying to decide if that food really is off limits, that, and you guys can probably speak to this a little better than I, but like, we're going to have some symptoms initially if you reintroduce something and we want to see what happens, but then we want to do it again, even if some of those symptoms arose, right? Because your body is adjusting to what happens the first and second. I'm right here. So,
yes.
Yep. So we want to try it. Then we want to try it again. And maybe there are foods that your body just doesn't like and you don't want, but I find that most of the time that's not the case, that as you're reintroducing that thing, we want to get people back to a place where they can eat anything and everything, unless they really do have an intolerance, which of course some people do.
Right.
But we can test for those and we would know if they have an intolerance, right?
Right.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, if you have an allergy or if you have, like, celiac disease like me, or if you have some overt sensitivity thing where your immune system sees the food and goes bonkers, then, like, take that out, at least for a while.
Yep.
I mean, some of those can go away, too. But, yeah, if it's like this measly intolerance where it's like, oh, if I eat one bite of avocado, it's actually okay. But if I eat, like, three avocados, I get bloated and diarrhea. You could start by just dipping your toe in the water and having just a bite, but it could be the most difficult step to get somebody to trust the process or trust you to a point where they're willing to eat that bite. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much dogma and BS, especially in the SIBO and the IBS world, where it's like, oh, the FODMAP foods are bad and grains are bad. And like, it's oftentimes not truthful, even if the food is causing symptoms for you in that moment.
Yep.
There's a reason for that. It's not that the food is evil or the food is bad. It's not like onions are cackling and saying like, ha, 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 let's make her miserable. Like, it's just, it's a food, and help your body process it better, but like, trust that your body will be able to process it better, I guess, is like the leap that is really hard for people to take.
Absolutely. Yeah. And something you're pointing out, Nikki, is that I said this earlier, that I even fell into the trap of that, of saying it's black and white thinking, good or bad, right? And it's very easy for us to simplify things, and very rarely is that ever, ever true, right? There's so much gray, and so we label everything that's not white, that's not perfect, our body has no reaction whatsoever, it's bad, 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 right? And there's so much more context to that that gets missed and gets lost in. So it's really helpful to identify those thinking errors, have people realize that maybe they're not thinking about that in the most accurate way. Challenge that with behaviors by eating a bite of avocado, see what's happening. And then even if they're having some symptoms from that, like, how do we flesh out what that could possibly mean aside from the fact that it's bad?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And yeah, I try to understand it.
Yeah, I love the idea of, you know, learning to trust your body's own reactions. And we can definitely go into that a little bit more. But I did want to make a point, too, about some of the diet restrictions as well. And I find that a lot of practitioners are really intense about diet restrictions in our space, the IBS-SIBO space, in the kind of more integrative space, and they're so intense about it that they like almost freak the people into having all this anxiety and things like that. And it just adds to any anxiety that's already there. So I'm curious, like, if you had the opportunity to speak to some like people in the wellness space that's working with IBS or SIBO or kind of gut conditions across the board, are there some things that you might say about their messaging or like how you would adjust things with how they're speaking to IBS? I see you smiling. You're like, yes.
This is a tough one, right?
Yeah.
Because I think so many people have their own lens. And so the three of us are sitting here talking and we sound pretty adamant about the way that we conceive of this and make sense out of this. And again, I feel like the science is, you know, we're going with data. Like, the reason I use cognitive behavioral therapy is because we have data and research to suggest that that's the most effective way to treat anxiety. And if there are folks out there, you know, treating anxiety with other things, I have a hard time with that. That doesn't make sense to me. Like, why would you not be using the thing we know that research says is most effective? And that would be true also with regard to, you know, dietary recommendations and diversity of foods and working to increase that. So it is frustrating, I think, when we're encountering people who have messaging that is quite contradictory to what we know is suggested by the research and freaking our clients out as a result.
Right.
Because I think what's so hard is with all the information available online now, it's very, very hard for consumers to find out what's real. because there's lots mm-hmm. of people who are definitely providing a very strong message that's contrary to what we know the science supports.
They'll give anybody a blog or a podcast, and I know because I have a podcast.
Yeah. Like, and, you know, and anybody can
they'll give anybody a
blog,
YouTube channel. Like, you know, it's it's frustrating too, because like I know in the functional space or like the naturopathic profession, straight up, I will tell you with a great deal of certainty, I have heard doctors in like the functional medicine or integrated medicine space basically come out and say that they intentionally scare their patients sometimes as a motivational tool. And I just wonder, like, how shitty of a clinician are you that you have to scare the pants off your patients? And like, a small piece of my brain sympathizes, like 1% of my brain sympathizes, because I have had those experiences where, you know, I talk to a patient who has like 5 autoimmune diseases, and I'm like, hey, maybe try to go gluten-free for like a month, see what happens. I don't know. Like, and obviously it's a more intelligent conversation than that, but like not even telling them to cut out sugar, not even telling them to cut out other things, just literally, hey, go gluten-free. And you would think that I asked them to saw off their left arm, barbecue it, and then eat it in front of them. Mm. And that's really frustrating as the clinician when you know damn well that there's something that could help a person, but they're refusing to do it. And there's been that one neuron in my brain that's like, I need to scare them. I need to tell them what would happen if their autoimmunity progressed or they got MS or they got something else. But then the better part of my brain is like, no, 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 you need to chill. And this person has their reasons, and you need to kind of do like, I don't know, like more motivational interviewing type stuff, like kind of lead them there in another way. So I get why clinicians go that route, but it ticks me off, because then the patients who A, were going to be compliant anyway, and they didn't need the fear mongering, or B, like they're more prone to anxiety, or they're already stressed out the wazoo. Those are the patients that then think like, oh my God, I'm going to die if I eat eggs. And eggs are toxic for my brain. And my mom had Alzheimer's, and this doctor told me I could get Alzheimer's from this. Oh my God. And they just take it way the other direction. And then they're eating like 10 foods and they're wondering why their IBS isn't getting better.
So as an anxiety therapist, hearing you say that, you hit it absolutely spot on, right? Because fear is not an effective motivator. It is not a good motivation for decision making, because I actually coach clients and teach them to recognize when they're making decisions out of fear and to not make that decision. Because it leads to the exact kind of thinking errors that you just demonstrated, right? Go into the worst case scenario, drop it into that black and white thinking and all of those irrational thoughts. Fear-based decision making is based on irrationality, and it doesn't ever lead us any place positive, right? It gets everything so distorted. So education and empowerment, I think, is a much more effective tool. And I mean, there is this aspect of things where people are gonna, you know, you tell them what would be beneficial for them, and they have the right to make a choice to not do that. It's frustrating for us to be like, no, no, but wait, this will really help you and you'll feel better. But
and that's something I've had to sit with as a clinician too, is just like, it's confusing to me. Like, people pay me good money to sit down and tell them what things would help them, and it's very confusing and frustrating when I feel like I care about their health more than they do, because they're not listening to my brilliant advice. But I've had to get better about my own mental health stuff and check out and say, like, it's okay. You actually don't have to save the world. Like, you gave your opinion, you tried to do your job, they can take it or leave it, but ultimately this is their journey, this is their life. You actually don't need to worry about it much beyond that. Like, you could care for the person and you can hope that they succeed in whatever they're succeeding at, but like, it doesn't necessarily reflect on me. Like, I tried the best I could, but I would rather have that internal conversation and realize like their success is not actually a reflection on me and my abilities necessarily. Versus thinking, ooh, I have to scare people and like make them be compliant. It's like, no, I don't have to do that. And I don't want to do that.
Yeah. And it's the, you know, one of the least effective ways to go about it anyway.
Yeah. And it's yucky.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. So when you're working with clients or patients, Julia, tell me a little bit about, like, I know you mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy. And I know you have some other tools in your tool belt that you're using with your patients. Tell me a little bit about some of the strategies that you're using in a little bit more detail.
Mm-hmm. Also, can I ask for like a really crash course version of what is cognitive behavioral therapy? Because I've heard I've heard what it is, but I have no idea what it would actually look like. Yep. Like you could lock me in like a weird vacuum chamber and rotate me upside down, and I would think, all right, cool, if you say this is what it is. So what like what would a session look like, and what actually happens when you do cognitive behavioral therapy?
Yep.
And that also Amy's question.
Yep. So I'll just give you the spiel that I give clients when I say, hey, this is what it might look like to work with me. And does that sound like that would be a good fit for you, right? Is that something mm-hmm. you'd be interested in? So one of the first kinds of interventions I use is mindfulness-based interventions, with the idea being that the present moment is the only moment that we actually have. Mm-hmm. And so when lots of folks who are struggling with anxiety are in the place where they're ruminating about things that have happened previously, which are moments that have already come and gone and we can't do anything about, or more likely they're negatively anticipating something that is never going to happen in the future, right? What you were just saying, like, I'm going to eat eggs and whatever. This is going to cause some huge problem for me that doesn't actually yeah. happen. So we want to be able to learn how to orient to the present moment, to be here and now. And so there's a bunch of strategies that I teach people to be able to notice when their mind is wandering and mm-hmm. then be able to draw their attention back to now. So one of the things that I will often teach clients is, this is a simple one, but your breath, your body, and your senses are always where you are. So if you notice that your mind is wandering and you would like to be here instead of there, right? I want mm-hmm. you to place your feet on the floor. And if this is the bottom of your foot, right? These are your toes. You pick your toes up and you can feel the four corners of your feet. You can feel the mound of the big toe, mound of the pinky toe, inner and the outer heel. This is my huge opposable thumb.
you have weird feet.
Yeah, right? So if you set your toes down now and you can rock your feet around, you can feel the four corners of your feet on the floor, right? So we want to anchor into the body. So draw your attention to the body. So if you're paying attention to your feet on the floor, that's interrupting this process of that crazy making thinking where your mind is taking you elsewhere, right? So we want to be anchoring to things that are here and now, feet on the floor, butt in the chair, palms on the legs, right? Where you're anchoring into your body and feeling those not scary sensations in the body, right? We're not focusing on the belly or anything. We're focusing on relatively innocuous things. There's breath work that we'll do. So I teach a number of breath strategies which activate the calming part of the nervous system, which helps to turn that fight or flight switch off. Mm-hmm. And then just anchoring into your senses. So noticing five things that you see, noticing three things that you hear, right? All of that stuff is mm-hmm. right here and now. So this is like the first main level of intervention, where we're trying to gain more control over where you place your attention, and you get to choose what you want to pay attention to. So if your mind is taking you someplace that's not helpful, you can say, okay, here's something I can do. We got to give our mind something else to do. Otherwise, you're going to ruminate on, did I just ate that? What does that feel like in the belly, right? Or I have dinner in 2 weeks. I'm going to sit here for two solid weeks and worry about that dinner that is mm-hmm. probably going to go fine in 2 weeks, right? But you're going to be miserable for two solid weeks anticipating this yep. dinner date that you then cancel because you don't want to go to anyway, right? Mm. Like ultimate avoidance, right? So that is kind of the super quick version of, and there's so much more to that, but it's just the idea of being able to be in the present moment and teaching clients how to be able to do that. And then Nikki, onto your question about cognitive behavioral therapy, we just have a powerhouse of strategies and skills that come from this. But the model that I was giving you earlier, which is, and this is again a simplified version of this, but the idea that thoughts and feelings and behaviors are all connected and mm-hmm. impact each other, is so cognitive behavioral therapy being cognition is thinking, and then yeah. behavior is obviously the way that we behave or act. But some of those behaviors are not actually overt things that we do. Sometimes they're mental things that we do. So behaviors might not just be things that you do concretely, but they might be things that you do in your mind. which is a little bit tricky, but so what we want to do is be able to identify the way that people are thinking and the way that people are behaving and be able to intervene in those two areas to change the way that they feel. So how do we do that? So first we start identifying the way that people are thinking. So we've already started identifying some of these problematic thoughts, right? Black and white thinking. I would call it catastrophizing, where we're jumping to the worst case scenario. And we start having people be able to identify what kind of crazy things are you telling yourself, right? So many of my anxious clients say, my God, I got so worked up about that, like 2 weeks later, right? They're like, I can't believe I got so worked up about that. But at the time, it's real because you believe those thoughts that you're telling yourself, right? Mm. So what we want to be able to do is have people identify that they're thinking things that might not be true at the time they're thinking things that might not be true and start trying to undermine how much they believe those things. So I have exercises that I teach clients where we start percentage-based ratings on how, so here's the super scary thing. How much do you believe that that's true? Come up with three rational responses to that. Observable, evidence, fact-based things, right? And then rate your percentage belief in how much you believe those things. And oftentimes, like the super scary thing, they believe 100%. But the rational thing, they believe 90%. Second rational thing, they believe, yeah, that's actually true also, 90%. Third rational thing, yep, that's true also. Then we re-rate that initial scary negative thought. That percentage goes down, right? Because now we, in a structured way, started to have them identify the disjointed, kind of distorted nature of that super scary thought. And so that we don't get it to go away, but if we can decrease the percentage belief in that, then they're gonna, the intensity of that anxiety is gonna go down, right? So we start targeting the thoughts, right? The other thing we target are the behaviors. And this is like, send the damn email, right?
Right.
Refrain from engaging in those avoidance behaviors. If you have health anxiety, do not go to WebMD. I will repeat that. Do not Google things. If you're gonna just find scary things to reinforce.
Another one? Yeah. I tell virtually all my patients, go on Facebook and leave or unfollow all of your damn Facebook groups. Because there are SIBO groups, IBS groups, low histamine groups, allergy groups, all of those groups. Like, you can stay a member of them so that you can go and like ask a question every now and then if you really, really need to. But like, unfollow every single one of those groups, because I find that a lot of people have them default on the newsfeed. And then people are seeing all of these posts from other people with IBS or SIBO, and it's freaking them out every single day, all day when they're going on Facebook. So I think similarly, like, don't go on WebMD, don't go on those damn Facebook groups unless you want to lose your mind.
So this, and this is such a hugely important part of treating anxiety. This is that thing we were talking about before, like the intuitive things that you think you're doing to help you are making it worse, which is why so many people have a hard time overcoming this on their own. So like, if we're thinking about the things that IBS patients are doing, for example, to make themselves feel better, to provide some sense of control and security and safety and prevention, they have, and they don't go anywhere without Imodium, right? They make sure that they have voided completely before they go out. They avoid going out, or there's only certain places that they go and only certain things that they will eat. They know where the bathrooms are if they go out to places, right? Like so all of this are those avoidance behaviors that we need to strip away, because all of the things that they're trying to do to control, prevent, and manage are increasing their anxiety, which is increasing their symptoms. And it just creates this vicious cycle, right? So cognitive behavioral therapy is identifying the problematic thoughts, giving them tools and strategies to rein that in, and then identifying all the behaviors that they're doing that make it worse and getting rid of those. And once we start targeting that, they feel so much better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I love that. And that kind of is a good refresher for me. I kind of knew what cognitive behavioral therapy was, but I'm glad that Nikki was like, hey, can you give us an overview?
Pretend I know nothing, because I really don't, about CBT at least.
Yeah. Well, and I think, like, one thing which I think we touched on was that, you know, there's a certain level of trust in your own body and your own experience mm-hmm. to be able to pinpoint what's an actual true reaction versus what is a food fear or your anxiety speaking. In terms of, like, tips there, would you say, like, the obviously things like the cognitive behavioral therapy and things like that are going to help discern, but do you have anything else to add on, like, how someone can approach getting back in their body, trusting themselves, and being able to make that discernment?
Yeah, I think this is a really tricky one, right? Because so I have so many people that come to me that will it really feels like they're having the rug pulled out from under them, where we're starting to question all the things they think they know to be true. And so yeah. Now they're saying, so we say this all the time, right? I feel this way. My feeling is valid. And my physical feeling is valid. And I'm asking them to say, maybe it's not. Right. So I have a lot of clients that feel very much like they've had the rug pulled out from under them, because they now, even if they did trust themselves before, I'm asking them to start questioning the things they think that they know are true. And that really feels unsettling. So we're working to have them be able to, as we're asking these questions, right, we're looking for evidence. We're always looking for evidence. And we have to say that evidence is fact-based. Right. So like the avocado, they're terrified of avocado, isn't it? You know, and we're looking at the facts of how many times have you eaten avocado where it's been catastrophic? Like, what kinds of symptoms do you have when you eat it? If you eat one bite, is it right? So if we're going back to this cognitive behavioral model, we're identifying the things that they're saying to themselves about what's scary and questioning whether that's true. And then what the way that this works in combination is we then create behavioral experiments to test those things out, right? Like you were saying, Nikki, eat one bite of avocado and then see what happens. So we're creating experiments to test whether what they think is true is actually true. And again, this is that empowerment process. I mean, so much of what I do with clients is getting them to be able to trust themselves again. And we have to test some of this stuff out. And once they start having, but the other part of this, right, is that they have to take the risk. So eating the bite of avocado is scary. And so we, a lot of times what I'll do with clients too is to create an anxiety hierarchy. So we have, I'd say it's the mild, moderate, severe, and ain't no way am I ever doing that, Julia, you can forget about it category, right? And so we start on the mild end and we pick the, you know, least scary possibility, and we have them try that out and see what happens, right? And oftentimes really bad things don't happen. If really bad things do happen, it didn't kill them. They were able to live through it and navigate it. And even though that was uncomfortable, like even though maybe it did create bloating, it's not the end of the world. And so the more that they tackle those mild symptoms, they then move on to moderate symptoms. And by the time they get to the severe stuff, that stuff is not nearly as scary, you know? So it's, we're working through identifying what they're saying to themselves and checking to see how true that is using facts. And then we're creating more facts by testing those things out with experiments. And then they work through this process where they get to decide for themselves based on what they see and what they feel and what they know, to decide what they actually believe. And again, coming back to that place of empowerment where and trust that has to be, we kind of have to tear it down a little bit in order to rebuild it.
Right. And I think the interesting thing I've noticed with experiments, and I like that word a lot, I think it really takes experimenting to figure out what works and what doesn't.
Yep.
And going through the process with you, it sounds like you are able to help your patients along that process and help them with the experimentation process. And I think we mentioned it earlier, but what I found is that, you know, if anyone gets a slight symptom, and maybe this is coached in and part of the anxiety, part of the messaging that I think strong in the with some of the SIBO IBS things, like if you get an ounce of a symptom, that food's gone again. Like, that's a bad food. That black and white thinking of, hey, like, if I get an ounce extra of bloat with this food, it's out the door. And I think that that's the hardest part to overcome for people is, like, okay, they might have felt better on low FODMAP. And maybe there is some, fears that's driving that belief too, of like, oh, I feel better low FODMAP, but I haven't necessarily experimented outside of low FODMAP in a major way. Then they go and have a bite of avocado or something. They haven't had that in a while. They get the bloating, like a little bit of bloating. And I think that that's such like an important part of the process to push through, like what you were saying earlier, push through a little bit and see how your body adjusts. Because anytime you remove a food for a while, physiologically, the body has to adapt as well. I mean, if you haven't had a food in a while, it's perfectly natural for like your gut microbiome to need to adjust to new fibers and things like that. Even like if I oftentimes am bumping up carbs with my clients. So like if you're bumping up carbs, you're probably going to have to adapt to digesting more carbs, which there can be some bloating and some transition symptoms. That's usually what I like to refer to it as, but just understanding and having someone that can coach you through those transitional symptoms, I think can be really, really valuable because that's the trickiest part. It's so easy to slide back into the, the anxiety, like let the anxiety kind of take over and slide back into the thinking that like, oh, I just like have to be on low FODMAP. I have to keep avoiding these foods. It's the avoidance the second you're getting a symptom. And I think even my clients are so hypervigilant to the symptoms too. So there's an aspect of that as well. But yeah, I think the experimentation's so, so key and understanding that you might be a little bit bloated or have a little bit of like change in stool quality for a minute, or like there might be some of these changes that happen and that's okay.
Yeah.
It's kind of to be expected.
If
you haven't touched an avocado in 3 years, like your gut microbiome is going to be kind of shell shocked to see that food again. They're going to be like, damn, we forgot that existed. So give them a couple days to kind of process the new food, for crying out loud.
Yeah. The other thing that occurs to me as you're both talking is like you haven't had an avocado in 3 years and how delicious avocados are.
Right.
So part of what I'm also working with people on is being able to say to them, like maybe you feel better, more control, more managed, more preventative, even though some of that is a fallacy, right? Like it's not real if you're on a FODMAP diet.
Right.
But how limiting is that to your life? How is that affecting you? How are you living? And is that the way that you want to live? So I'm constantly having conversations with clients where I'm saying, what would you like your life to look like? Can you envision, you want to be able to go to dinner and not have to worry about, being fully voided before you go and all these things that you're doing in order to be able to live normally, right? And how to be able to invest in that and be willing to then take a bite of avocado and take the risk and allow your body to adjust to that. And then I want you to do that again, right? And give your body a chance to adjust to that. And we're doing that because of this larger way, this larger why, this larger vision that you have for your life. There's a reason that you're doing that because of all the limits that you're placing on yourself. That, a lot of my clients will say that I don't want to live like this anymore, right? Like, so we have to take the risk that you're going to have some bloating and you're going to have to go through that process to let your body adjust in order to live more fully.
Yeah. Well, and you can almost think of it too, like, I don't know if you have children, Julia, but like when you take a baby that has a very not diverse microbiome and you start to introduce solid foods, you don't go with that baby. You don't go from giving them exclusively milk or exclusively formula for 6 months of their life and then, bam, Chinese food buffet, baby. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't do that at the 6 month mark. You gradually, like, I remember this process with my 5-year-old. We started off with like a little bit of mushed up avocado and we gave her like a spoon. And then the next day we gave her a little bit more because we knew that her gut was going to have to shift. She was going to have to nurture some new microbes. and it was going to be a bit of a process. And then we gave her a couple days, and then we moved on to sweet potatoes or peas or whatever it was. But like, if we wouldn't do that to a baby, and we also wouldn't be surprised if the baby's poops were a bit different or like stinky or whatever, like if you know what to expect doing that to a child's microbiome, why would you take an adult who's been on a low FODMAP or low carb or whatever diet for sometimes years and then expect that you could introduce something with absolutely no changes? Like, there's going to be little gas bubbles. There's going to be a little bit of discomfort or changes here and there because your body is, again, kind of confused. Like, oh, we haven't seen this in a long time. Cool. But let it take that time to shift and adapt and then see what comes of it rather than automatically thinking, oh my God, withdraw. Oh my God, this yep. was a bad thing. And again, I'm going to throw my profession under the bus again, because this is like a 2x daily occurrence on the podcast, by the way, is I give functional medicine shit. Because again, like, part of the problem too, and I think it's all in the name of compliance, and it's sometimes in the name of like the ego of the physician or whatever it might be, but doctors are oftentimes, and like naturopaths and whatever, are usually so dead set that like, all of these things that came back on a food sensitivity test, like that is gospel. Or we need to do this specific diet for this specific diagnosis, and that is gospel, because that's what I was taught by the expert in the seminar or whatever. That like, a lot of times there's also this added bonus of like, you need to be in tune with your body, and any little teeny weeny weeny symptom for like 5 days after you eat that morsel of avocado is a bad thing, and you need to like abort mission and return back to your diet. Or even worse, and I'm sure you've seen this, Amy, with the SIBO space, the idea that, well, even if you don't feel worse, you're feeding the SIBO. Or if you don't feel worse when you eat sugar, you're feeding the candida. And then it's creating this distrust and this disconnect where clinicians are teaching their patients, no, you cannot trust your body. You cannot trust your symptoms. Yep. You have to stick with my diet because me and my smarty pants brain and my ego told you so. Because like the other person told me so. But it's like a lot of SIBO patients can tolerate FODMAPs. A lot of candida patients can tolerate complex carbs and even like a little bit of sugar, and they're not going to explode into bits. And we're having them restrict unnecessarily when there really actually isn't a lot of evidence that SIBO diets starve SIBO. And there's not a lot of evidence that like lower sugar or low carb diets starve candida.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very common thing that's accepted, but it's actually not that well researched in those particular conditions. But I see a lot of that fear, again, coming from the clinicians telling their patients this bullshit, and then they come to people like us and they're like terrified to even look cross-eyed in an onion out of fear that, well, even if I don't feel bad, I'm going to be feeding the bad thing, and then it's going to win and I'm going to lose. So.
Right. And I think, Nikki, to your point, I literally just like 10 minutes before we jumped on was answering an email about, I'm worried I'm going to be feeding SIBO or feeding fungal issues. So that's a really common one. And the frustrating part about that is you're right. Like a lot of times they never had issues with onion.
Yeah.
They never had issues with garlic, or they never had issues with some of the foods they're avoiding. But there's just like this fear that the SIBO is going to take over if they touch an onion or something like that. So that's super common. I like that you brought up that point. And I think, Julia, you were talking about something that was like very something I try to do with the clients that I work with, which is trying to have them see the positives of the food experience again. So like quality of life, going out to dinner, like, oh, avocado's delicious, like really trying to change some of their beliefs around foods, like not just labeling that onion as low because it's low FODMAP, or no, because it's high FODMAP, it's bad. Onion's delicious. Onion has, sometimes I'll even have people like, if they know, if they're afraid of an orange or something, orange has vitamin C, like really even kind of putting positive energy, positive beliefs back into some of the foods that they're fearful of. So I really like that you brought that up. And the taste is a great one too. Like, this reminds me of dinners with my grandmother who's passed on. Like there's so many different aspects of food, even beyond the nutrition side of things, that feed us in different ways. And I thought it kind of goes along with something I read on your Instagram page like a while back. You were talking about an even though exercise. Mm-hmm. I really like that, and I use it with my clients a lot. But, I think it's a really helpful tool because it really balances, like, okay, you might have, like, a symptom one day, but, like, you can balance it with a positive thing, too, just to kind of balance out the scenario. Mm-hmm. So, okay, I ate that meal, and it caused some bloating. Or even though that meal caused some bloating, it was really delicious, and I was glad I was able to experiment. Mm-hmm. Like, kind of that sort of mentality. You can talk a little bit more about it, but I really mm-hmm. like that tool.
Yeah, it's a really easy one, too, to have in your pocket. So this would be another one of those strategies that we're using to challenge the negative thinking or this potentially. And, you know, a lot of my clients that work with me know that I'm, like, we're not toxically positive. Like, we're going to acknowledge that bloating sucks and that you've got this GI thing and that you're dealing with these GI symptoms and that it's not fun and that there's a lot of this that is real and there's a lot of, we're going to acknowledge that there's some negative aspects to this. And yet, this is not all of it. There's no way this is all of it. And when we focus on just the negative aspects of things, we get anxious and we get depressed and we create our life completely around that being the only option. And that, again, is that really damaging negative thinking, black and white thinking, and inaccurate, irrational thinking that creates this depression and anxiety. So we want to have, you know, ways to challenge that. So the strategy you're talking about, Amy, is it's really simple. It's even though blank, comma, blank. That's it. And so when I always want clients to have this even though in their pocket, when you catch yourself being really negative, we're going to say even though, plug in the negative piece, right, comma, and the structure of this automatically prompts you to put the negative first and put something positive after the comma, right? So it's not anything you have to think about particularly extensively about. You can just say, start a sentence with even though. And plug in the negative thing that you're ruminating about, and it will automatically prompt you to try to balance that. Because if we're prompting people to try to balance, we want to acknowledge that there are positive things happening, not just the negative things. Because it's so easy to just hang out there.
Right, and I think you kind of made a point, too, with I think sometimes people swing the other way, like the toxically positive, and it's like you can't the amount of energy it takes to kind of be positive all the time when you're having symptoms and trying to ignore the symptoms can also be counterproductive. So I'm glad that's why I love that tool, because it's a great balancing act where you're still acknowledging that the symptoms are present, but you're also reframing kind of some of the positive stuff that's happening too.
Yeah, because the positives are real. You know, it is not all puppies and rainbows, right? Like, it's not all, but it also is not all of this negativity. Like, if COVID has taught us anything, like, there are so many negatives that have come out of that, and yet, right? And if we stay in that and focus only on the negatives, then that will be your reality. But if you choose to acknowledge that there are things that we're learning, there are, you know, potentially positive things that have come out of some of these experiences. And when you're in these, you know, negative spaces with your GI health, and you're able to acknowledge that, you know, with this even though strategy or some of the other strategies that we use, to look at the reality of the situation and to accept things as they are, then you have to acknowledge that there's some positive on the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
I like that. I wrote that down. I'm going to have to use that with folks
nice.
Too.
Yeah. And I was curious too, like, in terms of like, if people are interested in working with like a therapist and doing cognitive behavioral therapy and things like that, obviously if they're in a state that you're licensed in, I would want them to go to you for sure. how would like someone, if you had to give them tips on like picking a therapist or getting help, like, is there any particular things to look out for or things that they should pursue?
So I will admit there, I talk to a lot of mental health professionals and say, because when I moved to New York, you're introducing yourself to all kinds of clinicians. This was when things were normal and I could go to networking meetings.
Right.
And I would say I specialized in IBS and they're like, oh, really? What's that about? Right. So there's not a ton of clinicians, because I was even completely unaware of this until as I said, accidentally kind of fell into it. So you could be looking specifically for someone who is a psychogastroenterologist. They clearly understand these connections, right? And that is a growing field. And the Rome Foundation is a really good organization that will have folks who are specializing in mental health and GI issues. So that's an excellent resource where you can be sure to find folks who really do understand this stuff. On the other side of that, if you don't have a clinician who specifically understands the connection with GI issues, but they do, again, we're coming back to this idea of look for a cognitive behavioral therapist, because they're going to unearth the negative thoughts, regardless of the content, right? So if you're nervous about social stuff, if you're nervous about health stuff, if you're nervous about IBS and how your IBS is affecting you, then good solid CBT is going to be able to dig into those issues and identify what your specific thoughts are, what your avoidance behaviors are, and be able to create a customized intervention plan that's going to target those things specifically. But the other thing too is, like, be clear if you're looking for a clinician to say that you're nervous about, you know, this experience of IBS, or that your gut health is causing you stress, and just be explicit about that so they would know that that's something to dig into. Because that was, I mean, again, because I fell into that by accident, like, it just came out of conversations with clients. And then that was something that I knew to specifically ask about so that we can add that in as something that we were targeting. But that was something off my radar initially.
Yeah, that's great. I love those tips. Nikki, do you have any questions? I'm looking through my list. I feel like we covered most of them.
Well, Julia, you briefly touched on, you teased the idea of talking about the limbic system. So I'd kind of like to loop back to that. So again, like, assume that our listeners don't know what the limbic system is. Can you give us a little bit of a crash course of, like, what it is and the relevance and why you brought that up? Because you intrigued me.
Right. The way that I talk to clients about that is that example with the lion and the zebra. Right. So this is like the emotional center. It's our memory. Our memory is involved. And the reason that I bring it up a lot with clients is because of that threat center and the fight flight response and how that is so connected to anxiety. And so when we're talking about that emotional center in the brain that we're able to actually affect with, because that creates so much of these reactions, these automatic reactions that have us really, really quickly responding anxiously because our limbic system is helping us to label that email as a lion, right? And that's happening so quickly and so automatically and mobilizing the body to address, you know, what to do if there's a lion in place. So we could get into the technical details about, you know, the hippocampus and the amygdala and all those cool things that are going on in the brain. But I just simplify that for clients to say that this is like a really big part of your emotional center and where that threat center resides. And it's so, so cool that we are able to affect that with the way that we think, with the way that we behave, with the way that we talk to ourselves, with the way that we breathe, with the way that we press our feet into the floor. Like, you are really affecting what's happening in your brain when you start to do those things. And like some of the studies of some of this stuff, right? When if you stick someone in a functional MRI scanner before they go through some of these interventions and they take a scan of the brain and then they go through however many weeks of learning some of these skills and strategies and you thunk them back into that functional MRI scanner, you will see a shift and change in the patterns of attention and concentration and emotional regulation, right? Like, those areas of the brain are lighting up in a different way after learning all of these strategies because again, like I kind of nerd out on this stuff, but like neuroplasticity, right? Which is a fancy way to say that a lot of the things that are happening in the brain can be changed. We are able to make changes in the brain by learning these strategies and affecting what's happening in our brain by things that we do and think and learn. So much of this is a learned pattern of behavior that can be unlearned. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of work, right? And repetition and a willingness to be uncomfortable and a willingness to learn how to tolerate that discomfort. But we can affect the lizard parts of our brain and we can make changes in those areas by, you know, learning some of these strategies and practicing them regularly. Super cool.
Yeah. I love that. And I love just knowing that, again, like the limbic system and like the autonomic nervous system all affects the body, and then the body and the brain affect it. Right. So like you mentioned some of the bits, like the hypothalamus, the hippocampus, like a lot of the brain areas are connected too. Mm-hmm. So like the thoughts that we think with our smarty pants frontal lobe connect into and feed into every other part of the brain, everything from the balance centers in your cerebellum to, again, like the hippocampus, the amygdala, like your sense of smell. And I know like that's been something I've read a little bit about too, is that your olfactory nerves, your sense of smell, feeds more directly into the limbic system than some of our other senses do. Mm-hmm. So that
memory
even something simple,
right?
You smell a smell and you're like, oh my God, that's my grandmother's perfume. I haven't smelled that in 30 years.
Right.
Or whatever it might be. So even just tapping into something like essential oils or like having some nice scents around, not like air wicks and Febreze and that kind of toxic crap, but like nice smells, natural smells that aren't going to give you cancer down the road, but like having something around you, like a sensory experience that's pleasant and brings you joy, actually changes these parts of the nervous system too. And I think actually that's one more thing I wanted to touch on, is the idea that just doing something for the sake of it bringing you joy is okay, or eating something just because it's delicious and for no other reason is okay. But in this day and age with the Instagram and, you know, Facebooks and all of this, we see this culture, we see these like experts and these influencers who have perfect bodies and like perfect plates of food that they're posting online, and everything's organic and everything's perfect. And it makes you feel like such a loser eating your bag of potato chips or whatever. But if you could sit with that same exact bag of potato chips and have the energy of, oh, I shouldn't be eating these. Oh, why am I eating these? Oh, I guess I'll keep eating them. Versus these are delicious and they are salty and I'm enjoying the crunch and this is exactly what I wanted and this is a really nice treat. You're going to have a different experience. You're going to feel different. Like you may get bloated on one end and not bloated on the other end, or like with the different mental states.
Mm-hmm.
And you might like absorb the nutrition from those potato chips in a different way. Like I think that just experiencing food or experiencing things in life for the sole purpose of enjoying them and not labeling it automatically as like good or bad can actually be a breath of fresh air for a lot of people too, because we've been taught by society and the internet and clinicians that certain things are bad and we should not do them. And if we do, we get a slap on the wrist.
Agreed.
Yeah, I agree too. And I think one thing I sort of find what you're talking about, Nikki, is the idea of like cheats. Like, oh, can I cheat today?
Yeah.
And I think even just the subtle change of, like, referring to things that you typically refer to as cheats as treats. Like,
yeah.
If you feel like you're cheating because you're having, like, some ice cream or whatever it is, like, you know, that should be a treat, something that you would enjoy. Like, I think there's nothing wrong with having foods that you enjoy and that taste good. And, yeah, it's a tricky, I think it's tricky when so much of the messaging is guilt tripping and like this ideal of perfection from like just the wellness industry in general, but then you get into the IBS space too, where like, you know, the fears are there and things like that, that prevent it. But yeah, I 100% agree with what you're saying.
You will see no, you will see zero beautifully manicured plates of food on my Instagram feed. Damn it. They will be ugly pictures when I do post them.
Oh, good. Good to know.
With like shadows all over the place and like a dribble of something off the side of the plate.
It's going to be me. I'm going to be the one person that likes it.
You know, I think what's interesting too, as we're talking this through, is when I have lots of clients that we're working to have them be recovering perfectionists.
Yeah, you know, 100%.
For so long, we have used that, like, I'm a perfectionist, and maybe had worn that as a badge of honor. And it's really, really harmful and detrimental because we cannot achieve it, right? It's not possible. And so the more that, this is what we were talking about before, where like if it's not perfect, then it's garbage. And right. we're ignoring all of what's in the middle in between there. So when I'm talking with people about food choices that they're making, we're not even talking about like what you've eaten today. We're talking about what you've eaten this moment, and that the next moment is an opportunity to eat something else. And the next moment is an opportunity where we're really getting a lot more flexible and getting a lot less rigid about the way that we think about this stuff, right? So if you had ice cream last night, then that's contained as that you had ice cream last night, and that doesn't have to have anything to do with what you eat tomorrow, that you need to undo that, or that, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that compensatory kinds of behaviors that we do after we've eaten something. We feel super guilty about that. So if you're making a decision to eat ice cream, then you need to be intentional about that. Eat it and move on, you know,
and enjoy it.
Yeah, and enjoy that ice cream
for sure. Like the world is a better place with ice cream and all the things.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And do you miss like, Grater? Oh, I was going to ask if she misses Grater since she was formerly in Cincinnati.
I do, but I have to admit I'm a bit more of an aglomesis girl.
Pineapple.
I don't know what either of these are, but I can sense the drama.
There is a little bit of like a, I know there's lots of people that think that Grater's is the be all end all, which is delicious, right? Especially black raspberry chip. Everybody knows black raspberry chip if you've ever been to Cincinnati. But I'm telling you, pineapple pecan from aglomesis in the summer. It's a seasonal flavor. I would email them on their Facebook to be like, is this ready yet? Because I walked by there the other day and you didn't have it on the, you know, it's like coming up on July. We should definitely be having the summer flavors. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Delicious.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that we solved that problem for everybody for when they go to Cincinnati and they know. There's similar drama in Buffalo, New York with who has the best chicken wings, but that will be a topic for another podcast, perhaps. We'll have to find a guest who's actually in Buffalo, and then we can debate that on the podcast another day.
Yes.
But yeah, oh gosh, I feel like there was some other thing that I was going to throw out there also. I think it's gone. It's okay. It might not have been that good.
Well, and I think Julia, too... I have to ask because I'm a crime junkie. I know you're a forensic psychologist just for fun. Talk a little.
Yeah.
Do you have any like crime shows or things that you're into? I know Nikki's not into crime stuff, but I love it. So I always have to pick your brain if you're into any of that stuff at this point.
Absolutely. So it's definitely now much more of a hobby for me because I don't have to be concerned about it professionally. So I will say I'm a bit of a snob about what I listen to and what I consume because there's so much crap out there, right? Like I have so many people that will say to me like, "Oh, you should watch this movie." And I'm like, "No, I really can't." It's like if you're a physician and you try to watch Grey's Anatomy or something, like it's just you can't do it, right? Nikki, you can't. It's absurd. So there's so much true crime stuff out there that some of it's really good. So there's some I'm just looking to my podcast here. So Real Crime Profile is a podcast with a former FBI profiler, a profiler from Scotland Yard, and they will go through and actually talk through, they go, like they looked at the staircase and they looked at making a murderer, and they will talk through all the evidence and analyze whether it's, you know, like the story that was presented on the Netflix documentary, is that legit? And I have some very definite opinions about all of this stuff. And I have to say, I agree with the Real Crime Profile people. It was so validating to me. Like, I'm yelling at the TV or whatever, because I'm like, oh, okay, that doesn't really sync up with what, you know.
Right.
So I would definitely check that out. In the Dark. Do you guys know that podcast, In the Dark? So the Michelle McNamara thing with the Green River Killer?
Yes, yeah, I think you're okay. Right.
So this is a podcast called In the Dark, and it's an investigative reporting podcast that's excellent. So those are two really, really good podcasts I like. And cool. I will say, if I'm sure you, what's the Netflix, two seasons of it?
Is it Mindhunter?
Yes, Mindhunter. Yeah, so that was solid.
Yes, I like Mindhunter too.
Yeah, so I'll have, you know, friends be like, should I watch this? Was this any good? And I'm like, yeah, Mindhunter's solid, right? Like, I watched Mindhunter. It was very good. And there are others where I'm like, no, I can't watch that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Cool. No, I'm glad we all have those tidbits. Any other true crime people can go find some fun stuff to watch. Yeah, I never listened to Real Crime Profile, so I'm excited to check that out. My husband loves it too, so he'll be into it as well.
Yeah. I mean, for some people, it's a little less, it's a little drier because it's because it's real. So it's definitely entertaining, but if you really are interested in learning what's actually happening and like really breaking it down and learning about what's really going on.
Well, you heard it from the source.
Yeah.
You heard
this
it here
awesome,
first.
Guys.
Yeah, it was so fun. I think like this was really helpful just for me, and I'm sure it is you too, Nikki. And I think for everyone listening, this will be really, really great. So I'm so happy we were able to do this. And I do have, you can tell us a little bit about what you're doing, and then we'll link to everything.
Awesome.
When we release this episode.
Yeah, fantastic. So you can easily find me and follow me at Root to Flourish, root like a tree root, Root to Flourish on Facebook and Instagram. And then the website is also roottoflourish.com. And so there's an email newsletter that goes out on Mondays. And we're having some really great conversations in that email newsletter. Where we're going a little more in depth on some of the blog post topics. So there's tidbits that are coming out in the newsletters where we can dig a little bit deeper into that. So that those are all resources available now. I have a free training coming out called You Don't Have to Be Anxious. That should be coming out here in a couple weeks, which is a free video training with a corresponding worksheet where we're walking through some of the main elements that we actually talked about here today, mindfulness, changing thoughts, changing behaviors, and then a concrete strategy to get started on how to start addressing anxiety in all of those areas. And then the other thing that I'm super excited about is I'm launching a series of online courses called Anxiety to Zen. And those should be launching at least by the fall, if not sooner. And there's going to be an IBS-specific course with probably 6 modules where we're breaking down all of the education, all of the skills, and like being able to coach clients through on a self-paced basis to be able to identify their thoughts, their behaviors, and learn how to do all the stuff that we've talked about here today. To learn the landscape of their anxiety, learn the places where they can intervene, and find the skills for how to start addressing some of those things.
Oh, that sounds awesome. I can't wait to promote that.
Yeah, I'm excited. That would be fantastic. Yeah. So I think the first one that I'm launching is on overwhelm and worry, and is basically just more about kind of generalized anxiety. So that would apply to a lot of the things that people are worrying about. And then I'll get more specific. I think I'm going to do IBS next, social anxiety, health anxiety, and panic attacks. And then I have all kinds of stuff in the works that'll come after that. But that's the first step, is getting those that series started.
Exciting. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Sounds like you have a lot in the works.
I do. It feels good. And I think so. There's only one of us, right? There's only one of me. There's only one of each of you. We can only work with so many people one-on-one. And I'm turning away, you know, turning away clients at times when I don't have openings. And to be able to give another option for people to work through some of this stuff. And let's be honest, I have a lot of clients that are anxious that don't want to see a therapist. So I'm hoping that this maybe provides an option for people to, and there's a lot of clients who are anxious that if receiving this education, that they might be able to get some symptom relief, you know, on a self-paced basis. And of course, if that's not working, then they can reach out to a therapist. But just to be able to get this information out into the world and have people have some alternative solutions to some of this stuff, I think would be really helpful.
Awesome. So I guess we can just wrap up. I'm usually not the wrap up or the intro person.
But I'm so proud of you.
Am I making you proud, Mickey?
Go. You got it.
So, I mean, I think like to wrap up, we learned tons about how, you know, anxiety and overwhelm and things like that are going to spur GI symptoms or can spur GI symptoms. And even having gut symptoms and trying to manage your gut health can lead to anxiety. So there's interplay there. We talked about that stuff. And I think we talked about how cognitive behavior therapy can be very helpful. And getting into the present moment can be very helpful, building present moment awareness. We talked a little bit about the even though exercise, which can be a good way to balance some of the negative symptoms that are there while also acknowledging that the positives are still there as well. We talked about experimentation of having to kind of experiment to see what foods work and building trust in your own discernment of what's working for your body and what's not. Those are the highlights that I'm thinking of. Do you have any additional ones, Nikki?
The big ones, I think. I'm going to think a lot about lions now in my day-to-day life. And just like, see, and telling myself like, it's an email, it's not a lion. You're fine. You know, whatever it might be. So I'm very excited about that little brain nugget. And then I love the even though exercise. I think that's rock solid. And I think I certainly got a lot out of this episode and getting to talk to you. And I hope that our listeners did also. And we'll sure as heck promote this on our social media channels and the ibs.freedom.pod
podcast.
Darn it. On Instagram. I'll get there.
You're doing great.
And I'll send it out to my email list and the whole kit and caboodle like I normally do. So I'm excited for more people to hear this message and just realize that the gut and the brain are very much connected. They're BFFs forever. And you can influence one by working on the other. And sometimes you really need more of a top-down approach in order to manage your IBS more effectively.
Yep.
Right.
The other thing I'll underscore that I think came out of this too is, which is the message that I say send over and over, is that idea of you not being broken, that you not being at fault, you not being flawed. That this, and we really want to come from a place of being empowered. And so the first place to start is simply being curious and gathering data and just generating awareness. So I love that Nikki saying, like, just starting to see where your lions are and just starting to be curious about, you know, I'm freaking out about this email. Do I really need to be this worried about it? And sometimes simply labeling it as a lion that might not be a lion helps to bring the intensity of that down, right? So just starting with that place of like generating awareness and just starting to be curious and giving yourself a break and some grace can just be just a wonderful place to get started in addressing a lot of this stuff. Yeah.
Awesome. I think that's a good place to head out on. It's a good place to stop. And I just really appreciate you jumping on with us, Julia. We really enjoyed it, and we'll see everybody else next week.
Don't forget to like and comment and subscribe.
Oh yeah, shoot. I'm sorry, Nikki.
You done good, kiddo. You done good.
Oh, thank you.
We'll see you in the next episode.